Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are joined remotely by Daniel Freeb, a friend of the podcast, colleague.
Sorry. He's going to be really annoyed about that when he hears it.
He's not going to hear it because he doesn't listen to it. Fully-fledged member of the podcast, Daniel Freeb, is in Spain.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Lionel and I are in London. We are going to talk about the Tour of Spain and introduce Daniel's package from Spain, in which he has some exclusive interviews with Dave Brailsford, David Miller, Warren Barguil, among others. He's also spoken, I know, to Fabio Aru and others out there in Spain, and he'll be reporting back from Spain in a moment or two. And before that, we hear from him, Lionel and I are just going to reflect a little bit on a Vuelta that has been perhaps, arguably, the best of the three Grand Tours this season. Would you agree with that, Lionel?
Yes. In terms of the way the battle between Chris Froome and Alberto Contador finally shaped up, it's been very entertaining. The racing has been good to watch, but unfortunately, the Vuelta isn't quite the Tour de France. I know in Spain it has really captured the imagination. I saw, I think it was the Inner Ring tweeted something over the weekend to say that Saturday's stage to Ancares was the most watched stage of the Tour of Spain in Spain by a television audience since the broadcaster started broadcasting 30 years ago. So popularity is obviously peaking because of Alberto Contador, but also Alejandro Valverde and Joaquim Rodriguez. They've got a lot of, let's face it, aging stars. So you wonder how long that peak is going to last, because as we made the point on the podcast last week, and Daniel said this on Twitter also, there isn't exactly a generation of Spanish riders coming up behind those three. Contador, there's still plenty of life left in him, but Rodriguez and Valverde are well into their 30s now. They're not going to be around at the very top level for much longer, I wouldn't have thought. But in terms of the racing itself, the thing about the Vuelta is that it is action-packed every day, and with the time bonuses and the way that Chris Froome targeted those time bonuses, it wasn't as predictable and kind of formulaic perhaps as we have become used to seeing the Tour de France stages. I would also say though that really, apart from Ancares and the Lagos de Covadonga stage, the climbs are not as severe as individually the climbs are tough. But there isn't that repeated back-to-back four or five mountains in a day, which is what really kind of what wears down the riders in the Tour de France.
Hasn't made the racing any less interesting, has it? I mean, I think, you know, we've still seen a battle between the strongest riders in the race. It's still been whittled down to those two, three, four, five riders.
Absolutely. And look, I've said this before, and perhaps being a little bit too pragmatic and a little bit negative about it, but when you have repeated mountaintop finishes, really you don't learn very much on day four compared to what you learned on day one. The strongest rider imposes himself and then remains the strongest rider unless there's some spectacular collapse. And of course, Chris Froome on the penultimate stage on Saturday was hoping that with all that pressure that Team Sky put on to Tinkoff Saxo, that the chinks would appear in Contador's armour and that perhaps he would crack. Looking back, there was very little likelihood of that happening, even with his leg injury and the fact that he's recuperating still from that. It was a really interesting race on that climb. It's a very attractive climb to look at. The road itself is rough surface, it's narrow, it's incredibly steep. The countryside looks fantastic on TV, and to see the two best riders in the race basically float away from everybody else it was a captivating afternoon's viewing. But it was predictable in the sense that Froome wasn't going to crack Contador, and then Contador just pinged past at the end to win the stage, his second of the race, clinched the red jersey in pretty decisive style. It was great to watch, and the fact that suspense went down to the last weekend can't be overlooked. It was engaging all the way through.
I think it was, and in a sense it was the Tour de France that we were deprived of as a result of Froome and Contador crashing out, because I do think that those two would have perhaps been a level above everybody else. I think Nibali would have been there as well, and it would have been fascinating to see how the two of them tried to eat into the advantage that he had gained on the cobbled stage, of course, and it would have been close and Nibali might have won. But I think we saw, I think we possibly saw the race that we would have seen in July, because for me, all season, Contador has been riding a little bit better than Chris Froome, and Froome has been not quite at the level that he was at in 2013, and I think that's what we saw at the Vuelta. We saw Chris Froome, a slight shadow of the rider he was in 2013, and I think he comes out of the Vuelta with a lot of credit. I think most people could see that he perhaps wasn't at his very best, but he didn't stop fighting, he didn't give up. He instructed his team to really take the race to Contador, to make it hard, and you know, when Contador ultimately dropped him on that last summit finish, it showed that Froome's approach had been quite courageous, really. And I think he comes out the Vuelta with a lot of credit, and perhaps more fans, his popularity won't have been harmed at all by the Vuelta. You know, I think the very dominant Chris Froome was somebody who people didn't warm to so much, and seeing a more fallible Froome has perhaps endeared him to people.
Yeah, it's a good point, and I think you're right, Richard. The other thing is, there is this perception that Chris Froome is some kind of human computer, and that he's constantly looking at the SRM machine on his handlebars, which is telling him what his power output is, and that he is riding and tailoring his effort to those wattages. And in a way, I found the sort of rope-a-dope tactics he had, particularly in the middle mountain stages, where he was floating off the back or drifting off the back of the main contenders group and then clawing his way back. It was exciting to watch that, because you never quite knew whether he was fully on the limit or whether he was just judging it, pacing it perfectly. Clearly, he was using the gradient to his advantage. He was riding at the power output or at the feeling. It's not just about looking at a number on his computer. I think anyone who kind of thinks that he's riding like it's a computer game has got the wrong end of the stick. He's listening to how his body feels constantly and using the gradient to maximise the effort that he's putting in. So rather than sort of trying to plough away when the gradient perhaps doesn't suit him, you'd have to actually look at the way he was using the road, but he was riding very much on feel to make sure he got the most he possibly could out of his condition. Clearly not at the same level as he was when he won the Tour de France, and the fact that he got damn close to challenging Contador over the last weekend is a real kind of testimony to the way he plotted his way around a three-week race.
Watted his way around the three-week race. I think what we've seen at the Vuelta and the Tour of Britain, which we covered in our last podcast, is very human racing. I mean, we mentioned the Tour of Britain podcast, the inability of very strong teams to control the race in the way that we've seen in the past. They've fallen away. They have been very, very human and fallible. And we've seen that in the Vuelta as well. And I think we've seen a very human Chris Froome. And you know, you mentioned when you said rope-a-dope tactics, I didn't know where you were going there, but let's face it, there has also been suspicion around Froome. Just the level that he was at in 2013 did invite suspicion from people.
Rope-a-dope, I mean in the boxing sense of, you know, sitting back and allowing his opponent to get some blows in, soaking that up and then not...
Yeah, it was a joke, actually, Lionel.
Well, sorry. You know, the lawyers are listening. We've got to be very careful.
Yeah, it was just a joke. There has been suspicion. I think what we've seen is very human racing, and I'm not surprised to see Contador riding at the level he's been riding, because he has, I think he's worked extremely hard last winter. He's had a very good season. He was arguably the favourite going into the Tour. If his injury wasn't as bad as first suspected at the Tour, and he recovered quickly from it, then it's no real surprise to see him ride the way that he rode it at the Tour. I have to say that I don't think it's the Contador of 2009, 2010, even 2007, 2008, for that matter. He's not looked as comfortable. He's not had the zip that he had back then. He's not had that sort of lightning acceleration in the climbs. You know, he would just take off in the climbs. He's not looked like that. He's looked in trouble at points. He's been dropped at times. He's certainly let gaps go, and you know, he's clung on. But it's you know, Contador will be a very popular winner in Spain. And you know, I think this tees things up very nicely for the Tour de France next year. And I think a battle royale between Froome, Contador, Nibali. And then, you know, it's worth mentioning as well, I know we're going to hear from Warren Barguil later on, but behind those very established, experienced Grand Tour contenders that are dominating the top five, top six, Valverde, Rodriguez, Contador, Froome, you've got Barguil, Fabio Aru, who backed up a very good performance at the Giro with a very strong performance at the Vuelta as well. There's a sort of, you can see these emerging stars. Warren Barguil won a stage in 2013, but as we hear from him, I think his ride this year is better, you know, overall than in 2013. He showed himself to be a real future Grand Tour contender, along with his countrymen, Thibaut Pinot, and
the other one.
I've forgotten his name. AG2R.
Yeah.
Roman Bardet. How could I forget his name?
Considering his sister is friend of the podcast, Elisa Bardet, we really should remember Roman Bardet. Yeah, just a word on Aru. I mean, a real kind of breakthrough talent this year. I know he was kind of on the radar before this season, but his performance in the Giro and again here in the Vuelta, he's going to be challenging Vincenzo Nibali for number one status in the Astana team. We gather he is staying with Astana. There was some talk about him possibly moving on, wasn't there? But it sounds like he's staying with Astana. And as a sort of duo, if they choose to put both of those guys in the same race, that's a lot for anyone to contend with. I suspect that Aru may have to play second fiddle a little while longer to Nibali, as Nibali's the defending Tour de France champion. But Aru really has kind of come along and almost saved Italian Grand Tour cycling in a way, because although Nibali obviously now has a formidable collection of Grand Tour titles, he doesn't kind of excite and impose in perhaps the same way that a talent like Aru. I mean, the way he climbs is much more kind of fits into the kind of the panache bracket more so than Nibali's much more measured way of going uphill.
They're like the Chiappucci and Pantani of maybe not. Maybe that's Lionel's looking concerned at that at that parallel.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Fripp.
Shall we switch over to Daniel? Let's hear from Daniel in Spain. He's been mincing around Spain for a few days. And here...
You're just making things worse.
Sorry, Daniel. He won't hear that. The beauty is he won't hear this until it actually comes out. So let's hear from Daniel. Daniel Fripp. Daniel, are you there?
Well, thank you, Richard. I'll give this special Vuelta reportage my best shot. I arrived in Spain on the final Thursday. The race was already in Galicia by that point, in the far northwestern corner of Spain. The Thursday stage itself was fairly dramatic. We saw the Spanish riders, the so-called Spanish Armada, sort of tearing strips off each other yet again. Not really helping each other at all. And in fact, Chris Froome took back a little bit of time there, which kind of raised hopes about and what he might do in what was going to be the Queen stage and the decisive stage, really, to the Ancares and Puerto de Ancares on the final Saturday. But at this point, Contador was still very much in pole position. He was in the red jersey. On the morning of Friday's stage to Cangas do Morazzo, I spoke to Dave Brailsford, the Sky team principal, just a little bit about Froome and Saturday stage, but also his performance up to that point in the Vuelta and the kind of qualities that he'd shown in coming back from his crash in the Tour de France.
You know, I think his conditions coming into this, and I think he's ridden with such tenacity, I think is probably the right word, really. And the mental strength he's shown on this, you know, those early climbs when he was riding at his own pace and just let everything else go off around him, that takes some doing, you know, that really takes some doing. And he really put himself in, you know, put himself through the mill there. But credit to him, I think it showed everybody how strong he is mentally. And I think what he hasn't done, you know, is come off it. So if anything, he's sustained and maybe improved a little bit, and maybe the others are coming in and just fading a little bit, which is always the interesting thing about the end of the third week in a Grand Tour. You know, when you get to the end of the season, people come into the Vuelta from all different kind of routes.
Yeah.
So it's not as if it's the, you know, the Giro where everybody starts the season, everybody's up for it, they get ready for it and off they go, and the Tour, everybody's the biggest goal, everybody's up for it, off they go. I think here you get people who have prepared for it. You know, maybe Nairo came in fully prepared for the Welter, but then you're going to have somebody like Sir Contador, who come in sideways, didn't really expect to be doing it and found themselves here, and Valverde's done a lot of racing this year here. So people are at different places, and I think that's kind of part of the of what we're seeing, really, and which makes it interesting, really. But it's certainly a different race in its nature to the other two Grand Tours. And I think if you put everything else to one side, I think it's probably one of the... You know, it's been an exciting race, hasn't it? You know, it's been a great race. And, you know, I think we've really enjoyed it. And I'm sure, you know, cycling fans have enjoyed it too, because it's had that element of suspense, I think.
David Miller was riding his last Grand Tour in this year's Vuelta. Of course, David had very high hopes for going out with a bang at the Tour de France, but he wasn't selected. That was a fairly controversial decision by the Garmin Sharp team. Certainly as far as David was concerned, he wasn't very happy at all. And David had been sort of pottering along pretty well until, well, the second or the third weekend, in fact, the penultimate weekend, when he had quite a nasty crash. And when I saw him on Friday, he was pretty battered up. He had two sort of cracked bones in his fingers. He had a pretty nasty cut on his leg. So I talked to David a little bit about the experience that he'd had up to that point in the Vuelta and also about his injuries. So here you can hear me speaking to David again. This is on Friday morning in a place called Salvaterra Domini, Portuguese border. So here's David.
I had a really, well, stupid, unavoidable crash on Sunday, which was what, stage 14, I think, 15, where a guy in front of me, it was 20k's into the stage, and it was strung out, and the peloton just swung across the road, and the guy in front of me went straight into a bollard, Anthony Roux, and I just, we were going like 60k's an hour. I kind of almost missed it. My right foot clipped it, and then the next thing I knew, I was just on the floor, and kind of didn't do anything serious, but I didn't want to get x-rays that night, because I knew whatever happened, I was going to start the next day, so I got x-rays on the rest day, and I got two fractured fingers and a fractured rib.
You've got what looks like two teaspoons sellotaped under your fingers, but it's not, is it?
It does actually look like two teaspoons, yeah. They're like little guys. When you unfold them, they've got arms and legs. they're quite good because they immobilize, because they're just cracked, and it's just immobilizing because they're cracks in the joint. So, I mean, I can still ride, it doesn't hurt that much, and it's just inconvenient.
Right, okay. So it's not a case of you staying in the race only because it's your last Grand Tour, no?
No, I mean, I probably would stay in with this sort of... I'd only stop a Grand Tour if I literally couldn't do it. Yeah. So, I mean, I can still do it. And I got a cracked rib as well, but they're all things that heal quite quickly once you kind of stop, which is why I want to get through, because I still want to get world selection. I'm pretty sure that once I stop here, these will be, when I immobilise them properly for a few days, it'll be okay. And I got the fitness is there, otherwise I wouldn't be able to do this. Yeah. You know.
I mean, I spoke to you earlier in the race, Dave, and you talked about the lack of opportunities for your kind of rider, basically, in this race. Has that continued? It seems to have.
It seems to, yeah. I think it's proven. I don't know if that's modern cycling and the fact that you get such a... Whereas... we have guys now like Degenkolb and Michael Matthews who can win those sort of middle mountain stages and have teams that control it. So breakaway riders are getting less and less opportunities in Grand Tours simply because riders, the professional peloton, is getting stronger and better. Teams are getting stronger, the sprinters. Yet the Kittels and Cavs, who are great for pure flat days, or Cav can do a hilly day when he wants to, but then you've got these guys like Michael Matthews, Degenkolb, who can get over, I mean, proper climbs, which basically nullifies those stages, the stages that we would have normally considered good for us. But and then you have the fact that, because probably today is one of the actual days where a breaker goes to the line, there's the added fact that maybe Valverde doesn't want it to, because he can get points, go for the points jersey. Maybe Degenkolb can get over the last climb. You just don't know with that guy. And then there's 11 teams that haven't won a stage here, and there's just dozens of guys that haven't been in a break or once been in a break and have a chance. So we've seen the last few days, we've averaged 51 kilometres an hour for the first hour each day. It's always the way in Grand Tours. The first hour gets faster and faster as the desperation gets higher and higher, and more people want to get in the break. So yeah, same old. I think I'm glad I was part of my generation, because my type of rider is very difficult to win stages now.
And have you been able to sort of cherish the moment
as much as you ever can on a Grand Tour. Is that something you've been consciously reminding yourself to do?
Not really. Once you're in, you're kind of in your job, you know. It's just sort of you're doing what you do. And yeah, I mean, there are moments, but I think this crash kind of brings it home. I was just starting to feel so good in the bike and really enjoying it. And when it's good, you think, oh, I do remember why I love this, and I could imagine doing this for longer. But then you hit the deck at 60 kilometres an hour and break fingers and a rib and have to, like Wednesday was just purgatory. It was just horrific getting through that stage. And that's when it's like, God, I'm glad I'm never going to have to suffer like this ever again. It's just... it's horrible, and that's a good reminder of kind of actually what a lot of my career has been.
and you know, this is your last Grand Tour. You kind of hope that, well, you'd go out with a bang at the Tour de France as well. How long has it taken you to get over that? Or have you got over it? Or will you ever get over it?
I don't know if I'll ever get over that. I mean, it was I was just getting over it, actually, and then I did the Commonwealth Games and realised it was just... even I trained so hard for 3 weeks before, there was no way I could compete against the guys that had done the tour or been racing. And it was... and that angered me even more, because it was like, OK, missing the tour, I was kind of coming to terms with that, but then being Commonwealth Games, literally a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and not being able to be at my best, which I would have been if I'd done the tour, that just angered me even more. So I think it's not eating away at me in the slightest, it's just a bitter disappointment. It will always remain a bitter disappointment that I didn't get to see my last tour, but that's life, you know? I mean, there are bitter disappointments. But at the same time, I've had a great time here at the Vuelta, and, you know, a finisher in a bang, with a bang, as only I can, by hitting the deck at 60k's an hour, and I was just grovelling through the last one trying to survive. So yeah, it's quite nice. It kind of sums up my career in a way.
And I presume maybe one or two drinks on Sunday, and then a hill climb to finish, well, after the Worlds, to finish it off. What was the thinking behind that, Dave?
Well, Gary Beckett, who organised it in the Beck Hill Climb, I was a guest at their annual dinner lunch a couple of years ago, and Gaz has always been trying to sort of get me to do it, and he hasn't pushed me, mentioned it again, and I suddenly thought, you know what, that would be a really nice thing to do. You know, I'd style in Club TTs, it's near London where it kind of all started, and it's just, it felt right, and I'll have great form after here and do the Worlds and then come out and do that, and I think it'll just be nice, and my wife can do it, kids can watch, and it's all just a nice sort of family affair. So yeah, it seems kind
that
of perfect,
all took place on Friday. Yeah. Friday was a fairly quiet stage, and then we went ahead to the big showdown in the Ancares, which is I can thoroughly recommend to anyone who certainly rides a bike and likes riding in the mountains. Absolutely stunning part of the world to ride a bike, completely traffic free most of the time. To the top of the Puerto de Ancares, which is the main pass, which goes over the Sierra de Ancares. The route that the race was taking on Saturday had not been used previously by the Vuelta. It's a really tiny road that has been sort of heralded as the Spanish Mortirolo. It's about 9% average, 12 kilometres long. So it was going to be a very, very tough climb. And Froome at this point was still over a minute and was really going to have to give it everything to try and dethrone Contador at this point and throw caution to the wind, and which we'd seen prior to that in the Vuelta, he was quite prepared to do. So we saw the usual Sky tactic of trying to make the race hard, and they were on the front for most of the day, certainly in the back end as the race went towards the foot of the Ancares climb. And when the race got there, when the riders got there, we saw all sorts of attacks. We saw Joaquin Rodriguez really make the first inroad to Contador's lead, or at least for a brief moment he was off the front, and then we saw counterattacks from Froome. We saw Contador fasten himself to Froome's back wheel. Froome really tried everything to try and dislodge him on the hardest part of the climb, and then the gradient eased slightly, and as it did, Contador counterpunched and rode away from Froome, and that was really the last nail in the coffin as far as Froome's challenge was concerned, and Froome went on to finish well adrift of Contador, who won the stage and effectively sewed up his third Vuelta title. So that all occurred on the Ancares on Saturday afternoon, a very spectacular stage visually, and one that the Spanish fans certainly got very excited about. And that only left the final time trial on Sunday in Santiago de Compostela, a short time trial of 9.7 kilometres. There was a lot of waiting around
In the morning, there was a lot of time to kill for the riders. They went out to test the circuit, obviously, but the weather forecast wasn't very good, so there was some anxiety about rain. There was a cobbled section which was going to conclude the time trial, and that promised to be quite treacherous if it did rain. But in the afternoon, I was able to catch up with a couple of riders. I was able to speak to Fabio Aru, who the Astana rider, who'd obviously had a fantastic race and was heading for a fifth place finish. She was in Italian, so we can't listen to that. But I also spoke to Warren Barghi, the giant Shimano rider, who was the revelation really of last year's Vuelta, the 2013 Vuelta 1-2 mountain stages. This year had ridden extremely well again. This was really Barghi's first attempt at riding the general classification in a major tour, and it looked at this point on the final afternoon that he was going to finish in eighth place. And he really hadn't been fazed by anything over the 3 weeks, not even by calling him Roman Bardet at the start of this interview, which I'm hoping our editor has cut out because it was quite embarrassing. He didn't even flinch at that, and he was quite charming for the next 2 minutes, and made a very good attempt at answering my questions in English. So here we listen to Barghi talking about, first of all, the difficulties he'd had on the early on the stage to the Ancares, when he, for a brief moment, he'd actually thought about abandoning the race because he'd hit a Cannondale team car with his, and particularly on the flat sections, he was in real trouble for quite a while on Saturday, and then recovered as soon as the road started to go uphill, and ended up consolidating his position on general classification, and as I said earlier, looking very good for eighth place, which was where he would finally finish on the Sunday. So here he is, Warren Barghi, not Roman Bardet.
Hey, I am happy to finish this Vuelta. It was really hard during 2020 stage, and now it's last day today. I need to finish my goal. It was at the start top 15, and now I am 8, and it's really good performance for me and for the team.
And just tell us about yesterday, the state of the Ancares, the Queen stage. You had a very, very difficult first 2 or 3 hours of the stage. Now, at one point, you're even thinking of abandoning.
Yeah, I have really problem with my knee since I crashed with the Cannondale car, and yesterday it was really hard in the head. I have pain, but less to the day before. But in the head, it was really hard moment for me. But I have a good support with the team, and the guy really helped me. And one time I switch off and just think about finish the stage with the best result.
And we all remember your two stage wins last year at the Vuelta. And what's been the highlight of your Vuelta this year? What's been the best moment or the best day?
My best day is when I attack in stage Farapona with Contador and Rodriguez. It was a really nice moment. I saw some picture, and I am totally happy to see this picture
of you climbing alongside Contador. Yeah. And just last thing, Warren, you've been talked up as, you know, the next great stage race prospect in France. People are talking about when you're going to, well, first of all, ride the Tour, when you're going to win a Grand Tour. What's your timetable in terms of when you want to be on the podium of a Grand Tour?
I hope the quickest possible. No, I really don't know. It's to do the top 10, it's already a good result because you have a lot of guys who want to do that. And did the podium, I have need to work a lot in time trial, and I hope it's coming soon.
So we jump ahead now to Sunday's time trial, and the evening time trial, which finished in Santiago de Compostela, as we've mentioned, in front of the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela. A couple of interesting early finishers, one of whom was David Miller, who, as we talked about earlier, was riding his final Grand Tour. He'd been very, very emotional, David, on the Ancares, in tears. He knew it was his last time riding a Grand Tour, actually in a team, so starting with his teammates that morning. And the time trial was going to be different, of course. Time trialing is something he has been renowned for throughout his career, but this was his very last action in a major tour. And he came over the line
and started to speak to Matt Rendell of ITV Sport, and Matt asked him a couple of questions. He mentioned the sort of emotional scenes the previous day, at which point David really broke down and then was pretty inconsolable for a while, or certainly didn't want to speak, and we kind of left him to contemplate the moment, and he promised that he would speak to us later after he'd had a stiff drink, but we managed to catch up with him much, much later on, at which point he was not particularly interested in doing interviews, which is understandable, but that brought the curtain down on David Miller's career, certainly as a Grand Tour rider. A little bit later on, well, quite a bit, his Garmin Sharp teammate Dan Martin was finishing the Vuelta in seventh place overall, his first top 10 in a major tour, which he was very happy with. So here we're going to hear Dan Martin just after he's finished his final time trial and, like I said, sealed his seventh place on general classification. Here's Dan.
Would you have signed for that before the race, seventh overall?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously, looking at the competition, it was one of the strongest start lists in history, I mean, the Grand Tour. It was like everybody was here apart from Vincenzo, you know, well, mostly, you know, so it was an incredible, if somebody told me I was going to get seventh, but of course, anything can happen in a Grand Tour, you know, and I knew I had good legs, and I knew after the tour last year I can do a good Grand Tour, but yeah, obviously to bring it home this time, it's a big relief actually, because I've come close to bringing home a good result before, but never quite finished it off. So yeah, to actually get it home, it's really great.
Will it change the way you think about Grand Tours and maybe doing general classification in future?
Not really. I think I'd always approach them in the same manner of just going for stages and then see what happens in the, because I think so much can happen over 3 weeks that it's difficult to actually like focus on the GC, but yeah, at the end of the day, it's still a part of cycling. It's a huge part of cycling, especially with the tour now. And it's nice to be able to show that. Obviously, I've shown in 1 day races and one week stage races now. Yeah, to show I've shown progression in Grand Tours now as well. So it's for the future. Obviously, it's interesting.
Last thing, Dan. A couple of big 1 day races before the end of the season, Worlds and Lombardy. How do you rate your chance? Obviously, Lombardy's a big one for you.
Yeah, obviously how I'm feeling now, I'm a bit worried about Worlds, so I feel quite tired at the moment, but yeah, I'm sure in 2 weeks' time I'll freshen up and it'll be really, yeah, I'm looking to do something at Worlds for sure, and not Lombardy, obviously I've got a great record there. They've changed the course this year, I don't know what it's like, but it's Lombardy, it'll be hard, so it's, I love that race, it's one of my favourite races of the year, with the Ardennes, Lombardy is probably my favourite race, so it's, yeah, I'm really excited to get to do those races, we're bringing a really strong team as well, then I go to Beijing as well, so still lots of racing left.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So after Dan Martin, we're going to digress slightly and go back in time a bit to another Dan who was finishing his first Grand Tour full stop. That was the Namibian Dan Craven, who is familiar to a lot of followers of the British scene. He rode for Rafa Condor and was picked up quite surprisingly. I think the most surprised of all was Dan Craven himself when he Europe Car, Jean-René Bernardeau's Europe Car team earlier this year. And he was given his first Grand Tour start in the Vuelta. He looked incredibly fresh at the end of the 3 weeks. He looked like he'd had the time of his life, which you'll hear in this interview, he certainly had. The only thing that looked fairly bedraggled about Dan was his beard. It's very long, straggly, if I'm allowed to say unkempt, facial topiary that he's sported throughout the race, and which has brought him quite a lot of... This is quite a long interview with Dan, but I think it really kind of brings home the thrill of someone who was... as I say, riding their first Grand Tour at age 31. So here you have Dan Craven.
You know, the funny thing is, I had some health issues in the past, and as much as this, as a lot of people are saying that this was the Grand Tour of the year, you know, with the competitors, and apparently there's been more climbing here than at the Tour de France and all kinds of things, as much as all of that I can't argue with, this is easy in comparison to how I felt last year. Like, I woke up this morning and I was feeling pretty knackered in comparison to how I felt all 3 weeks, but I felt completely fresh in comparison to how I felt in June, July last year, every single morning I woke up after not having trained, you know, because I had a virus. So it's kind of, you know, it's like even though it wasn't a grand tour, even though it wasn't physical exertion, I've had to go through something that was harder than this. So
your longest race before this was what, about 10 days? Or?
I've done 3 10-day races, but like years apart. 2007, the Baby Giro, 2009, King Eye Lake, and then at the beginning of this year, I did the 10-day tour of Morocco as well. So, yeah, 10 days to 21 days, bit of a difference.
And just to sum up some of the highlights and what have been the real highlights and maybe things that have surprised you about doing your first Grand Tour?
I think the reaction to me has got to count up.
It's just the beard, though, isn't it?
It's the beard. Well, mainly. If it wasn't for the beard, people wouldn't have noticed me, put it that way, definitely. If it wasn't for the beard, John René probably wouldn't have noticed me. Well, no, I did kind of try and give his riders a hiding in 2011, so he would have noticed me, but he really noticed me because I had a big beard then.
I think Tinkov, while you were just talking to Matt Rendon from ITV there, I think Tinkov was standing over there wanting some kind of selfie with you.
Oh, really?
I think he was poised, then he let you go. But anyway.
I love that. I mean, you know, I'm 31. Just joined the World Tour at the age of 31. The only other person I know of who's done something similar is Swain Tuft, who, you know, when he went World Tour, I was still, I don't know, 26 or something. And I remember when he did, I was just like, oh, man, you're a legend. You're awesome. And now I've kind of done what he did, except that he is a really, really good rider and I'm not quite as hard as he is. But you know, the fact that I got World Tour at the age of 31 kind of stood out for a lot of guys. And that my first World Tour race was a Grand Tour. And then obviously the beard. So when I rocked up in the field, all of these guys were just like, you know, who the hell is this?
Including kind of Spanish guys, you know, people.
Everyone.
Big names, yeah.
Absolutely everyone. And I mean, at the start of the tour, the whole way through the tour, I'd have people coming up to me and be like, hey, I heard that, you know, and it's just like...
For example, they heard what?
That I have a university degree, that I speak 5 languages, that I come from Africa, you know. So it's obvious that people are kind of like, hey, there's a weirdo with a beard, and then start talking. And I kind of realized as the tour went on that my last race before this was Tour de l'Ain, and I didn't do all that well. And I knew why I didn't do well, and I went to London to see my osteo and sort it out. So I came here knowing that I'd go a lot better than I did there, and I kind of have worked out since then that a lot of people saw my result at Tour de l'Ain or watched me at Tour de l'Ain and were like, ooh, he's going to die at the Vuelta. And you know, day one I was there, day two I was there, day three our first rest day I'm still there, second rest day I'm still there, and I kind of noticed a bit of a shift in the way certain people would sort of talk to me. It kind of, especially in the last week, you know, people would come up to me and they'd start talking to me, and I can't put it in words, but I definitely noticed a bit of a shift. And I'm assuming it's like, oh, this guy can actually ride a bike. He's not just a Europe car going for some cheap publicity stunt or something like that. And you know, all I can say about that is thank you, Jean René, for having the faith, because I know that, you know, a lot of people thought he was crazy. And I'm not saying that I validated him, because I don't think I've had a good tour. By no standards do I think I've done something other than finish the tour and do a bit of work for my team. You know, I failed in getting into a break, which was a major goal. You know, I got in a few breaks for a few minutes that were then brought back. And I didn't ride as strongly as I know I can in the future. No, I will in the future. But just having had, you know, I had a virus, which we kind of worked out I would have had for about 5 years. And the virus kind of had knock-on effects, which caused other things. So I'm still kind of uncovering all of the issues that it caused. Which is, you know, why I had to go to London to see my osteo, because I only recently you've discovered that my left ankle is this major weak point. But because I had all of these other bigger problems, I never kind of noticed that in the past. And now it's sort of unearthing the smaller, finer problems. And it's like, you know, I'm so excited about this off season because now I can start fine-tuning the small things because the big things are out of the way. And, you know, with this massive block, everyone, that's another thing, you know, everyone is just telling me after a grand tour, you're just going to have this engine. And even in the time trial today, sort of that one drag, I was just like, oh, I'm dead. And then just push a little bit more. And I'm like, hey, what's going on here? I was like, oh, this is what everyone's talking about. Just that sort of, you can just keep on pushing. And to finish a grand tour, to finish my first world tour race, which is a grand tour, and be able to have that feeling instead of just being knackered, I'm just like, oh, this is awesome. This is, I'm just like, I'm so excited about next year. You know, I'm kind of like, I've got 10 race days left this year, but I don't really care about them because I'm just so excited to get things sorted for next year.
And just lastly, the beard now, well, it's obviously got a lot of admirers. It's got its own Twitter account, I think.
Insane.
Yeah. What is the fate? What is the future of the beard?
Basically, I think I look like an idiot without a beard. So,
how long have you had it? You've had it for quite some years. Perhaps not as long as it is now, but.
Well, no. The first time I raced with a beard was 2010 in the Russ in Ireland. Good old Russ. But ever since I've had facial hair, so since I was at university, I think 2001, 2002, I started playing with facial hair, sort of doing a goatee or whatever, sideburns, you know. So since I've had facial hair, I've been doing stuff, but it's only since 2010 that I've actually had a beard. One thing about the Grand Tour, about this tour, that just I loved was I'd constantly have guys coming up to me, but I mean like guys like Gilbert and Cadel Evans and Dave Miller, and they'd be like, Dan, so-and-so, Dan, you know, like one of the first days Cadel came up to me and we were on a drag and he's like, dude, just do yourself a favor and shift into the small blade. I'm like, oh, thanks, you know. And then the next day he came past, he's like, dude, when the bunch is nervous like this, don't be in your drops, because I was down in my drops, go on your hoods, then you can look up and you can see when people are. He's like, oh, thanks, you know. And then the next thing, Milo is coming up to me and telling me something, and then I'm having a discussion with a Balkan guy that I've never met before, and he's telling me stuff, and I'm just like, you know, it's I don't know if they just treat me like that or if they treat everyone like that, but I get the feeling that I was getting some special treatment. And it was really, I came here being quite afraid that I'm going to be this outsider intruder and people are going to be like, whatever. And I'm leaving here kind of with this feeling of, I felt so at home. Like, I really felt at home in this bunch. And it's a nice, you know, it's just like, I suppose if you have an office job, when you get a new job and you just walk in the office and you're like, yeah, I like this vibe. I walked into this office and I was like, I like this vibe. I can hang around here, which is exactly the same for, you know, joining Europcar. I mean, French team, my French still sucks, but I just love the vibe. I'm like comfortable there. So
excellent. So the beard's going to stay anyway. I think I've understood from that the beard is going to stay.
Oh, was that even a question? There's no doubt about that. It's staying. Even if it's just because I think I look stupid without it. But yeah, and I mean, after getting all of the attention that I got at this race, at the end of the day, you know, my job is to be a billboard, and I would be kind of stupid to cut my publicity. If I cut my beard off, I'd cut my publicity by 95%. It'd kind of be very stupid. So it'll be trimmed. The hair will definitely be trimmed. The beard staying.
So that was Dan Craven, whose facial topiary was quite a talking point in Spain. Another rider who was sporting a beard on Sunday, and indeed throughout the Vuelta, was John Degenkolb of the Giant Shimano team, who was the leader of the points competition. So when he'd finished his time trial on Sunday, he was wearing the green jersey. But he had a fairly anxious wait because there were other riders who could potentially have taken it off him had they won on Sunday, Alejandro Valverde being one of them. It didn't happen. But at this point, so midway through the time trial on Sunday, ITV's Matt Rendell kicked off the questions by talking to John Degenkolb about the challenges of winning the green jersey competition in Spain.
Yeah, I mean, you have to fight for every single point, and especially here in the Vuelta, it's even harder than in the Tour, and to win the green jersey. But we will see. I really hope to succeed today, and that I can take this jersey home. I've got so many jerseys in the bus. We collected, I think, like 40 jerseys, or like every day at least two. And I would love to give everyone of the team a jersey. I mean, probably I'm doing it anyway, but it's nice if you. We also can say we won it together, and everybody has won at home. So we will see.
Could this Vuelta have gone any better for you in terms of Worlds preparation, or has it been just about perfect?
I think it's more or less perfect. I mean, I was twice really close also to win a stage again, so that would have been six stages, and of course that's more nicer, but I mean, we can be really happy. We have Warren Vagil in the top 10 of the GC, so there's nothing to complain about the last 3 weeks.
And a lot of debate at the moment about the world's course, and people saying it is going to suit a sprinter in the end, or it's not. What's your feeling now, 2 weeks from the World Road Race?
I haven't seen the course yet, so I can't say anything about it. I mean, I'm very motivated for it, and we will see. Now I have to recover from 3 weeks of hard racing, and then I hope I'm ready in 2 weeks.
So that was just about it in Santiago de Compostela as far as me harassing riders was concerned. The real action, of course, was yet to take place, the leaders finishing their time trials. Not that there was a great deal of suspense, because everyone stayed pretty much as they were. The top five remained in those positions after the time trial. So Contador, remember, led Froome by 1:10 going into the final time trial. We're just going to hear Contador coming over the line now, and a little bit of atmosphere from the finish line, both as he finished his Vuelta, so his third Vuelta a España victory, and also during the podium presentation. So here you go, a little taste of the atmosphere on Sunday evening. Here over the PA there, the Spanish commentator, Contador on his way in. Very gingerly going around the corners, again on this very treacherous road surface, onto the cobbles now. And here he comes. The two has managed to avoid disaster, it looks like. Very slow time, but there's no need to take any risks today. He's up here off Chris Froome, and he's going to cross the line in just under 13 minutes, I think. And here he comes. Raises his fist, a clenched fist. He can finally smile. And there goes again that fist. And the trademark Pistolero salute, I'm sure we will see. Seen Bjarne Riis get out of the Tinkoff Saxo team car, embrace Stephen de Jong, the Tinkoff director sportif, who's masterminded this victory for Contador. Contador and currently trapped in a huge swarm of photographers and reporters on the finish line. The lights fading here in Santiago de Compostela. And there we see the pistolero gesture that we've seen many times over the years, and probably too many times, some would say.
La señora Nava Castro, directora de turismo también de la Junta, y también el señor José Ramolete, secretario general de deportes de la Junta de Galicia. Todo eso para hacer entrega a nuestro hombre que tenemos ahí en el podio, también Alberto Contador, pero quiero escuchar a ver cómo suena aquí. Yo digo el nombre, todos el apellido, con todos vosotros en el podio, Alberto. Alberto Contador, con la capa de peregrino, con el peregrino también, y con la presencia también.
Okay, we heard there from Daniel Freib, and we'll be all together again the next time you hear this podcast, myself, Lionel, and Daniel. We'll carry on as a weekly, I think, for the foreseeable. And we, as I said earlier, in the Tour of Britain podcast, I said we're going to have a special soon with Theo Gegenhardt, the young British rider who's agreed to join us again. So let's wrap it up. That was the Vuelta. Next on the agenda is the World Championships. We'll be looking forward to that in our next podcast. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Are you going to Spain for the World Championships at all?
Sadly not. Are you?
Well, no, I'm not. There was a rumour that Daniel might be going, or is that not happening now? I'm not sure.
I hope he is. Otherwise, what are we going to podcast with?
How will the World Championships go on without us?
It'll be a bit threadbare. But we'll do something. We'll sort something out. Don't worry. Anyway, thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.